This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our first guest, Samantha Bee, was The Daily Show's longest-serving correspondent. But when Jon Stewart was leaving, she left too and started a new show of political satire called Full Frontal, which premiered in February and was just renewed through the rest of the year. It airs Monday nights at 10:30 on TBS. Like she did on The Daily Show, she brings a feminist perspective to the stories she covers, and she's really funny. She's also an executive producer and writer on The Detour, a new TBS comedy series starring her husband, Jason Jones, who is also a former Daily Show correspondent. The first episode of her show, Full Frontal, began with a sketch where she's at a press conference taking questions from reporters.
Anybody have any questions? Oh, yes.
Is it hard breaking into the boys' club?
Okay. What's it like being a woman in late night?
How can I watch a show as a man?
What's it like to be a female woman?
Oh, you're gonna have a problem with your ovaries falling out. Sam, what did you have to do differently to make the show a reality?
Okay.
As a woman.
Okay, you know what it took? Hard work, a great team, maybe just a little bit of magic.
Samantha Bee, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your show and on your
Thank
show
you.
Getting renewed.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's great to be here.
So I think I want to start by asking you your reaction to the Vanity Fair photo of the late night show host. And it was a photo of all these men in suits. and you know, so in this photo, there was Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, Larry Wilmore, John Oliver, Conan O'Brien, Bill Maher, Seth Meyers. Your show wasn't on the air yet, but you had mm-hmm. gotten the show. It was close to starting. So what was your reaction when you saw this photo and you weren't in it? And tell us what you did in response.
Well, I was actually, when I first saw the photo, I was with my kids. We were at a pumpkin patch on Long Island, and my children were playing on this beautiful wooden playset, and I just happened to scroll through my Twitter like an irresponsible mother, and someone had tweeted it to me, and they were like, where are you in this picture? And it was just this whole spread, you know, like the centerfold spread of all of these men in suits with cocktails in their hands. And I really, my blood did definitely boil. I definitely felt my, you know, prickly heat on the back of my neck. And I excused myself from the playground. My husband took over, and I went into the little cider house where they were making cider donuts. And I texted a friend of mine, because at the moment that the photo came out, we were already working on Full Frontal and developing it. And we, you know, we had this stupid idea, my friend Miles and myself, to make a picture of me as a centaur with laser eyes. It was for a different story, like a completely different. So I just had this weird photo on my phone already that we just found terribly amusing of myself as a centaur with laser eyes. And I don't know how to Photoshop.
And a centaur is half horse and half human.
Half horse, half human. Yeah, that's me. And so I texted Miles and I was like, how can I get the centaur photo into this picture? So I sent him the Vanity Fair picture. He did it in 2 seconds from his home computer, and he sent it right back to me, and I just tweeted it out. It was just a visceral, I just knew what I needed to do in the moment. It was like, and there was a space in the picture, you know, right at the center point of the picture where myself as a centaur would fit perfectly into it. And so I felt that I solved the problem of what was missing from the photo, and I tweeted it out. And with zero expectation that it would, you know, take the world by storm or whatever, but it really did connect with an awful lot of people, and I felt so gratified by that. It was a good moment.
It was hilarious.
It was a good moment. Can I say one more thing about it?
Yes.
Can I say one little thing about it?
Absolutely.
Which I think is true. It was funny actually seeing them all across that centerfold spread. Really drove home the message of how many men there were in late night comedy for me in a way that, I mean, I knew it on a cerebral level how many of them there were, but really physicalizing that with a photograph was astonishing to me. I felt I belonged in the photo.
But, you know, the other thing about that photo, it shows how much competition there is. Now, you're not all on at the same time, mm-hmm. but you're all mm-hmm. talking about similar events in the news. You're all talking to some degree about the primary and about mm-hmm. certain other issues. So you must really feel this sense of how do you stay original when there's so much competition with people talking about events in the news?
Well, it's funny. I don't really feel the competition. I don't want to step on other people's toes, but I do think that we tell stories differently at our show. We see things through a different lens. I think we see things from a woman's point of view, actually. I really do. I think that we distill information in a way that is slightly different.
Can you think of an example of a story other people are covering, but you think you're covering it differently from a woman's point of view?
Well, you know, when we watch Hillary and Bernie at a debate, by way of example, and he shushes her, we internalize that shush on a level that I think other people wouldn't, because we've been shushed and we've been told to smile, by way of example. You know, we've been steeped in those feelings for an awfully long time. So when it comes out of us, it's an eruption. The reaction to being shushed is an eruption, I would say.
So let me play another clip from your show. You were talking about a job fair for future women. This is a job fair for girls,
right.
which you called Samantha Bee's hashtag roar, you go girl, job fair for future women. Lean
That's
in.
Right.
and it was the segment was about how we encourage girls to like dream big, but in reality, they often face like sexism or sexual harassment on the job. And you illustrate that with various stories about like women working on a cruise ship, women working in the National Park Service. And then you move on to your field, stand-up comedy.
You know how people are always like, I wonder why there aren't more female comedians. Maybe it's because every time a woman opens her mouth to tell a joke, someone tries to It's not a lot of guys, hashtag not all men, hashtag please don't leave me messages. It's just a few guys getting away with harassment and assault over and over and over again.
There are women that I know that will go into an improv scene as a scientist, and then a guy will grab their boobs for no reason whatsoever. So in the real world, you wouldn't meet a scientist and then honk her boobs.
You'd be surprised. That's another reason Marie Curie should have worn a lead apron. The problem is so persistent. Female comedians in Chicago, New York, and LA have set up secret online groups to share their stories and warn each other which serial predators to stay away from. Hooray! Sisters are doing it for themselves. And by it, I mean law enforcement.
One woman, Erica, it took her years to say something about her alleged rape, and she posted in the group just saying the guy's name, and five women wrote to her telling her that they had had similar experiences.
Hey, if you don't like them comparing notes, you shouldn't have taught them yes and. I'm sorry. Remind me again, what is the point of encouraging little girls to dream big if any career puts them in the path of boob honkers? There's not a workplace on land or sea or even at the bottom of a big deep hole in the ground where we're actually keeping women safe. Right now, I'm actually picturing some guy saying, ugh, what am I supposed to do? Stop asking women out of work because it makes them uncomfortable? Yes. You are at work.
And that's Samantha Bee from her TBS show, Full Frontal. So has the show gotten you looking for sexist bills and sexist statements in places that most people aren't paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, we have an incredible research team, and we have great writers and just really motivated, passionate people. So we're always looking into the cracks and crevices to find something that we can talk about. And it's not hard, believe me. You know, many of the people who come from small towns come from places you wouldn't think. And if you read the local newspaper from the town you grew up in, there are treasures. They can be absolute treasure troves of interesting stuff, interesting stories to tell. There's no shortage of interesting stories to tell is
right.
What I'm saying. I mean, we're batting away great stories all the time and putting them on a list for the future.
My guest is Samantha Bee, who now hosts her own show of political satire Monday nights at 10:30 on TBS. And before that, she had been The Daily Show's longest-serving correspondent.
Yes, most senior citizen correspondent. That was me. I hung on for 12 years. Never letting it go. My death grip.
So I want to play another field interview that you did. And mm-hmm. this has to do with abortion. This was an interview with a Republican state congressman named Dan Flynn, who was mm-hmm. one of the authors of an abortion bill, HB2, that passed in Texas and is now being contested in the Supreme Court. And it would close women's clinics that don't qualify as surgical centers. And to qualify as a surgical center, you have to adhere to expensive and, according to critics, totally unnecessary building regulations, like requiring extra large hallways mm-hmm. and requiring that janitors' closets be a certain size. I think mm-hmm. these are largely made for hospitals and not for small clinics, these yes. regulations. So mm-hmm. we've edited together the interview excerpts of your interview with Dan Flynn that are sprinkled throughout this piece. So I hope you don't mind that we did that.
No, not at all.
The correct answer. Thank you.
yes.
So here's Samantha Bee with Texas State Senator Dan Flynn.
My name is Dan Flynn. I was one of the joint authors of HB2.
Oh, this uterus expert.
The issue for this bill mm-hmm. was to be sure that we provided health care, safe health care for women.
How does removing access to health care increase health care?
We're not removing access to health care. We're improving.
So the intention of the law was not to do away with abortions.
No.
It was just to make them impossible to acquire.
You know better than that.
Do
what do you mean
I?
Impossible? I'll tell you what, anytime you start cutting on people's body, you need to have it in a procedure where it can be healthy.
Of course. You don't cut a woman in an abortion, though.
I'm not a doctor. I don't know, but I listened to many doctors tell me about the procedures that happen when you do an invasive surgery.
You don't seem to know anything specifically about abortion, really, at all. And yet, you did all this with building regulations. What?
You gotta feel bad.
We do.
Have you thought about regulating the safety of back alleys? Because that's where a lot of women will be having their abortions.
I don't believe
now.
That.
You don't?
No.
What?
I just don't.
Okay.
I don't believe that.
They are.
I don't.
It's true.
I just don't think that happens. There certainly are exceptions.
Like in the tens of thousands of exceptions.
I don't believe that. Where do you get those numbers?
Reality.
I think you're wrong. You think I'm wrong.
Hey, I think you're wrong.
You think I'm wrong.
I think you're the wrongiest.
Yeah, I think you're the wrongiest.
I speak with the authority of one who has a uterus. And I guess that's why I think that you're the wrongiest, wrong-headedest, wrong person.
Well, I can tell you some things about a man that you wouldn't understand. I need to do a better job of educating you.
That's an awesome pep talk.
Yeah.
Next time I need to regulate men's bodies, I'll be sure to get in touch.
That's Samantha Bee with Texas State Congressman Dan Flynn from her show Full Frontal. How did you get mm-hmm. him to talk with you?
He was very willing to talk to us. I mean, he's passionate about the issue that he's passionate about. Mm-hmm. We happen to disagree so strenuously.
That was clear.
with one another. But he really wanted an opportunity to say his piece. I think we gave him that opportunity. You know, it's funny because I feel like, you know, people always ask us, why would these people ever agree to be on your show? And all they really want to do is express their point of view. So he knew on some level that we were going to make jokes, that we were absolutely going to disagree. And we did. And it was fine. We both walked into the situation with our, you know, with clear heads, and we walked out in a friendly manner. It wasn't actually a really tense situation at all. We just literally completely disagree about abortion. We disagree on the facts of abortion, actually.
Well, because he seemed to think it was a surgical
yes.
procedure where the woman
yes,
is cut open.
He really doesn't know anything about abortion. I'm not kidding. He really doesn't know how they... He's never been to an abortion clinic. He doesn't really know how they happen.
Did you know that going into the interview? Did you know that he thought that abortion required cutting a woman open?
Well, that's a very common belief that's a very common myth that is passed around in the crowds that he runs in. So I assumed that he would think that. I assume that he thinks that, you know, a routine abortion is just a bloodbath.
So you and your husband, Jason Jones, who is also a former Daily Show correspondent, both have new shows. You have Full Frontal. His is a comedy series called The Detour. Mm-hmm. Very stressful
yes.
situation.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
How do
yes.
you, and you have three children. You have three young children
we do.
At home.
Yeah.
How
we
do you not pass on the stress of two new shows to your children?
Yeah. I don't know that we're always successful at protecting them from our personal stress levels, but they think we're just lame enough. It's somehow we do it. I mean, somehow we keep our stress on lockdown. I'm pretty good at, you know, doing all my family stuff in the morning, and then the kids go off to school, and then I run to work and work in a really concentrated, really, really focused way. And then I run home from work, and then I just do kid chores and make dinners and do all that normal stuff. So their routine hasn't really changed from the way that we're working. What has changed is that they see our posters in the street, but it still doesn't impress them.
This is probably too personal to ask, but you have...
I love personal questions.
All right, here it comes.
Here we go. Oh, boy.
So you have three children. You
yes.
are an only child. I mean,
yes.
you're a busy woman. You work mm-hmm. in television. Why did you want to have three children? You know, one is a lot. Two is really a lot. Three is really, really a lot of responsibility.
It is. I don't know. I think maybe I was an only child, and I enjoyed being an only child. I wasn't, you know, scarred by that or anything like that. But it is fun to see them as a team. It's beautiful. They love each other. One's 10, one's 7, one's 5. They sleep in the same room. They have bunk beds. They really get along. They're like B. Jones Jr. team. I don't know. I can't explain it. I really can't. I had one child, and the moment I gave birth to my first child, I knew I wanted to have a couple more. I don't know why. Maybe I was more scarred by being an only child than I thought, and I wanted to build my own team of built-in friends. I was a really shy child. There is value in building a unit of built-in friendships for your kids. It's like giving them, you know, almost when we had the second one, we were like, here you go, Piper, here's your friend. We made one for you. And then when the third child was born, we were like, here's now, guys, you're together now. Let's go. Yeah, sure, it's a lot of responsibility, but there's so much joy. I love my children so much. I don't know. I can have a very stressful day, but it's so corny. I can't believe I'm going to say it, but it absolutely, like, refills my buckets of love to go home.
Did you worry during your pregnancy, like, you worked when you were very pregnant on the Daily
Show?
Oh,
yes. Massive.
And
Every time.
You used that as part of the joke when it was relevant. But mm-hmm. did you worry when you took time off afterwards that people would forget you or that you'd lose your spot?
Actually, The Daily Show was a pretty great place to work. It's funny, when I was pregnant the first time, because you hear all of those horror stories from the entertainment industry, actually, about being pregnant and on a show, and it's like a big deal, that I was so nervous to tell John that I was pregnant. I mean, I really was worried about it because I didn't know what was going to happen, and I was so ridiculous. And then I went and told him. I feel like I was shaking, and I was like, I have something to tell you, and I don't know how you're going to feel about this. Can a pregnant woman even be on TV? And I told him, and he was so happy for us. I mean, just so genuinely warm and happy. And I don't think we could have actually had three kids if we'd worked on a show other than The Daily Show, which was incredibly family friendly for us. They made it so that we could be there for our kids. So after that, I was like, well, then a baby is like a prop, and a pregnant belly is the most amazing tool in a comedy sense. It's terrifying to people. You can use it with abandon.
What's the best way that you used it, do you think?
I do remember doing a piece where I was pretty huge. And I can't remember what the actual context of the piece was, but I was doing a man on the street at Columbus Circle. And at some point, I just took off and ran down the street. And I was massive. And people were horrified and terrified that I was doing that. And I ran around the whole of Columbus Circle. I just ran away, and the camera stayed on me. And it was just this giant pregnant woman sprinting down the street. It looked so funny to me. I loved doing it. It was so shocking to people. And everyone was like, are you okay? Oh, my God, are you okay? And for me, I mean, I knew that I could sprint down the street. I wasn't doing anything that would put my child at risk. I just knew that I would never do anything that made me physically uncomfortable, but it just totally worked for me, and it was a really funny joke, and it was fine.
Who were you comedically before you got to The Daily Show and developed a voice and personality as a news satirist? Like when you were doing sketch comedy and starting out?
Yeah. I can't really characterize what I did. It was it was a very rewarding period of my life. And certainly one of the women that I did sketch comedy with works on the show now. Her name is Alana Harkin. She's incredible. And I guess I did a lot of characters. I definitely loved being on stage. I never did stand-up. It was really more character-based and more written for me. It definitely wasn't news satire, although I was certainly motivated and interested. I was into news. I read things. I was interested to learn about the world. But that didn't, my comedy wasn't really infused with that at all.
How come you never did stand-up?
It isn't for me. The lifestyle is not for me. And by the way, I love stand-up and I admire great stand-ups so much. I love watching stand-up. I just absolutely, I think it's terrific. But the lifestyle's not for me. I don't stay up late. I'm such a nerd. Oh, I'm just describing this super boring person, but I get up really early. Like my ideal life, I get up really early and I do fun things all day. And then I go to bed at, you know, 8:30 at night. And I've sort of always been that way. Being a night owl, standing on a comedy stage night after night, because when you do stand up, you have to be pathological about it. You have to be so driven to do it and do it well. And that's just not, that's not in my makeup.
Do you go to bed before your children do?
I go to bed shortly after my children do. Yes, I do. I go to bed fairly early. I tried to stay up late last night to watch a TV show with Jason, and I had a pillow. I took a pillow and a blanket to the sofa, and Jason just looked at me and was like, ugh. He's like, why don't you just go to bed? And I was like, no, I'm going to watch a show with you. And within seconds, I was completely asleep. I made myself so cozy. Who wouldn't have fallen asleep? It was impossible not to.
Speaking of stand-up, it seems like one of these decisions you had to make when you were starting your TBS show is whether mm-hmm. you would have like an anchor desk or whether you'd be talking standing up. And you went the standing up route.
I went the standing up way because, you know, I'm just tired personally of seeing people kind of parked behind a desk. I mean, that just visually doesn't look, I like it, and I'm a consumer of shows where people are sitting behind their desks. I have no objection to the desk personally, but I knew that it wasn't for me. And also, my face is just naturally very expressive. I have a little bit of a rubber face, I think. And sometimes if I'm trapped behind something, I just pull a lot of faces and I do weird stuff with my body and my face. So actually, you know, I only came to that realization after we didn't have the desk because we knew we really just couldn't have a desk. But I'm so grateful that we don't, because I feel like I would be crawling all over the desk and kind of going crazy behind it. I don't need it. I'd rather be full frame. I'd rather use my body. It really helps me a lot.
Well, Samantha Bee, congratulations on your show. It's really funny.
Thank you.
Glad you have it.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for coming back to our show.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
Samantha Bee's new satirical news show, Full Frontal, airs Monday nights on TBS. She's also an executive producer and co-creator of her husband Jason Jones' new comedy series, The Detour, which premieres this Monday on TBS. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album by Robbie Foulkes. He's probably best known for his lively, sometimes raucous, country, folk, and pop songs. But his new album, Upland Stories, is more quiet and contemplative. Working with his longtime collaborator, producer Steve Albini, Foulkes has created what rock critic Ken Tucker considers a frequently beautiful collection of songs.
A red tailhawk sat watchful at the faded edge of day. The phone poles and the pines rose from the scoured clay. The sun was slipping toward the gulf in its own good time. And you would not think of death if you drove on past the signs. The old men at the roadhouse weren't too.
Robbie Foulkes is so often praised for his musicianship and his witty lyrics that he doesn't get the credit he deserves as a vocalist. One element of the excellence of his new album, Upland Stories, is the strength and variety of his singing. You heard the high, lonesome edge of his voice in the song that began this review, Alabama at Night. Now listen to the impeccable nasal control he maintains on the bluegrassy Aunt Peg's New Old Man.
We came up the hill to meet him in the dirt patch he was weeding. That was our first look at Aunt Peg's new old man. Uncle Hank was 75. He lived well and then he died, and none of us had nothing against her new old man. She likes fiddling, no doubt, liked his help on the rural route, and the rest didn't bear thinking about Aunt Peg's new old man.
Folks has lived in Chicago for a long time, but he's also spent time in North Carolina, part of what has been called the Upland South, and from which he derives the album title Upland Stories. Folks tells a lot of stories on this album, assuming different identities. In one of the most detailed and moving of these, Folks is a dying man who returns home to seek some rest and comfort. He finds only bad resentments and a miscalculated sense of whether your family will always welcome you back. It's called Never Come Home.
I had scarcely laid my back down when my misjudgment hit me square. I was welcomed like a guilty prisoner. Old grievances fouled the air. 400 miles mean nothing. One man's troubles are his own. Land is run down and ragged. I should have never come home.
I could listen to Folks' conversational singing on that song forever, I think, relishing phrases such as, I was welcomed like a guilty prisoner, old grievances fouled the air. What he's getting at over the course of this album is at once simple, a bumper sticker, life is hard and then you die, and something infinitely complex. Life is always unpredictable, and each of us is forever taking the measure of our loved ones and of our country.
Some rule from the sky, some inch cross the ground. Their bent backs turned to all heaven above sends down. Scratch and puff from this earth, what gold it may give. Fattening on feasts to come, laboring now to live. And America's a hard religion. Not just anyone may endure. America is a hard religion. Some never do surrender.
The music throughout Upland Stories is a marvelous mongrel mixture. Bluegrass banjo picking, honky-tonk pedal steel, stark folk phrasings on guitar and fiddle. The tone of the lyrics tends toward the severe, relieved every so often by a bit of sly romancing, such as this song, Sweet as Sweet Comes.
Baby, I'm coming as fast as the law will let me. If it wasn't for the money, I'd never leave you alone. Being close by you just lifts the whole world from me. You're on my home, sweet home. Try not to wander.
Doing some research for this review, I got sidetracked on YouTube watching some performances Folks and his friends gave in Chicago. Known for his surprising cover versions, Folks was especially satisfying ripping through Shania Twain's country pop hit, I'm Gonna Get You Good. It was a reminder of how much Folks thinks about all kinds of music and how good he is at squeezing out the humanism, however large or small, that resides in every song that interests him. It's a humanism he creates in varied abundance throughout Upland Stories.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Upland Stories, a new album by Robbie Folks. Our next guest, Dan Lyons, has reported on and satirized the tech industry. He reported on the industry for Newsweek and Forbes. He wrote the satirical Fake Steve Jobs blog and has been a member of the writing team for the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley. He was laid off from Newsweek shortly before it discontinued its print edition. 9 months later, in April 2013, when he was 52, he took a job in the world he'd long written about and became the marketing fellow at a startup called HubSpot, which sells a marketing software platform designed to help companies attract visitors and turn them into customers. At this startup, Lyons was the old guy, twice the age of many of the people he worked with. He stayed less than 2 years. He's written a new memoir called Disrupted, My Misadventures in the Startup Bubble. He describes the book as the story of what it's like to reinvent yourself and start a new career in your 50s in an industry that is, by and large, hostile to older workers. He also wanted to puncture some of the popular mythology about startups by providing a look inside one. Dan Lyons, welcome to Fresh Air. So a couple of years before you were laid off from Newsweek, and this was not long before they just basically went under, Newsweek had a cover story back in 2011 headlined The Beached White Male. And describe what was on the cover. And
it was a hilarious cover. It was very controversial. It was a picture of a guy in a business suit face down on a beach. He's just been washed ashore. And it was a story about how the downturn in 2008 and 9 had disproportionately hit white males in, say, their 40s and 50s. And white men of a certain age who had attained sort of high-level jobs got washed out and then found themselves unable to find anything else. And there was this whole generation of guys about my age who found themselves in this terrible predicament, sort of shuffling around their houses in bathrobes. They were like zombies. And I read it at the time, and I was gainfully employed at Newsweek thinking, well, that's interesting, but it's not going to be me. And then, yeah, 2 years later, I got the axe, and I thought, oh, my God, I've become a beached white male. You know, I'm that guy.
Okay, so you really needed a job because your wife had left her job because of chronic migraines. You had two twins who were about to turn 7. You needed health insurance. You needed a job. And so you got a job at a marketing tech company in Boston, near where you lived, and you were going to be the marketing fellow. So describe, like, what the company did and what your job within that company was going to be.
It's a software company. They make software that's delivered over the cloud. So you don't actually buy the software in a package and install it on your computer. You just get a subscription and you use the computer on the cloud, on internet service. So it's internet-delivered software, and it's aimed at marketing people. So it helps you find customers. You can send email. You can write blog posts. You can track who's visiting your website and then contact those people. So it's essentially software that helps companies find customers. And my job was going to be to help sort of build brand awareness by writing articles that would make people in the industry or potential customers aware of this company and somehow build a link in their minds that they should start thinking about buying this software.
So you were in your early 50s. You joined this, you know, a startup. Can I call it a startup?
Yeah.
And the staff is, what, mostly in their 20s and 30s?
Average age was 26. A lot of people right out of college. A smaller number of people in their 30s, and the people in the 30s were really the grown-ups. Very few in their 40s. I think I was the only one in the 50s, and there was one guy who was older than me who was in his 60s. But yeah, very, very much a culture of people all in their 20s.
And that was uncomfortable for you. So what made you most uncomfortable about that?
Well, it wasn't uncomfortable at first. At first, I actually really liked it. It reminded me of a place where I worked right out of college at a computer trade magazine where I was right out of college and everybody else was, and we had a blast, and our magazine was growing and booming, and it was very exciting, and we had a lot of new ideas, and we had a lot of fun. And at first, I really liked it. I didn't realize the company skewed so young. I thought there would be a greater diversity of people. It's just hard to fit in sometimes when you have, you know, if you're married, you have kids, and you want to go home, and you don't want to build your life around a company. You don't want to go to parties. You don't want to go kayaking or do team building exercises. But I don't think the age thing was so much of an issue. I sort of really learned a lot and enjoyed working with young people. I just think it would have been more fun to have a few people my age around.
So can you remember back when you were working for that magazine and everybody, or the publication, and everybody was really young, including you, when you were right out of college? What did you think then of people who were 52?
Oh, I thought they were ancient, you know? That's the thing. I remember exactly being that age, and I remember thinking, go, just leave, you know? And then I've become that guy, right? I've become the grumpy old man kind of thing, yeah.
Did you feel like you were seen as the grumpy old man, or that you were becoming the grumpy old man?
Yeah, I think it was funny. People, well, like when I first started, people would, you know, when you come to a doorway and you're going out and someone else is going in, and they were very nice kids. A lot of them would hold the door and call me sir. They'd be like, "Oh, sir, here, please, you go first." And it was kind of like, and I was like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, they almost looked like they saw a ghost. You know, like, oh, ooh, you know, my parents are here. You know, so that was awkward. But no, I didn't feel like a grumpy old man. There were little sort of comments a lot all the time about. I never felt old before this.
So one of the things that seemed to bother you was like language differences, like expressions that were used. Too many exclamation points in emails. Talk a little bit about what you saw as the language differences between what you were used to as a journalist and as someone who is 52, and a lot of the writing and emails and texts that you were getting.
Yeah, I think that's not so much a generational thing as it is sort of a cultural thing. I think journalists tend to be very skeptical and cynical, and we kind of have a dark sense of humor, and we also don't like jargon. We sort of see jargon, and it makes our skin crawl, and we see it as our mission in life to sort of undo jargon and put it back into English. And in a world of marketing, it's kind of the opposite. You're the ones making the jargon and embracing it and promoting it.
So what's an example of the kind of jargon that really irritated you?
Well, it's two. One is a word called delation, which was like a made-up word, which they would use a lot, very seriously, without any irony. Like, we engage in delation, which really meant delighting your customers, making them happy, doing anything you can to make the customers love your product and have a great experience. And, yeah, that kind of makes your skin crawl, I think, when you are someone who works with words. There's another one they came up with, which was this expression, 1 + 1 = 3, that, you know, our software is so magical that 1 + 1 = 3. And then they would use that as kind of an adjective, like you'd say, well, how about if we tried this? And they'd be like, I like that idea, but it's not 1 + 1 = 3 enough. It was just its own language. The company had kind of its own language and its own words for everything. And a lot of it was about obfuscation and euphemizing things that were sometimes unsavory.
You describe the company that you work for as a cross between a frat house and a cult compound.
Yeah. The frat house culture was they had every year on Cinco de Mayo had this big party and brought in all this tequila and Mexican food. And the CEO would run around wearing this giant sombrero and kind of getting loaded. And everybody would just party up. And there were refrigerators stocked with beer all the time. And people would be at their desk like, a lot of the sales guys would just come to work in shorts and flip-flops and T-shirts and backward baseball hats, and they'd be drinking beer. I mean, they were literally frat guys who had just left college and, like, just continued for them. And this was like a corporate frat house for them. They could go grab a beer, start hitting the phones, calling people. They'd party, you know, at night and stuff in the kitchen. And there'd be a lot of just life that was very much like a frat house, that people literally had just come from frats and sororities. And the cult compound stuff would be, I think the best example that I remember is in training. Ostensibly, you're in training to learn how to use the product, and you do get training on that, but you also get this big dose of how great the company is, how lucky you are to be here, how hard it is to get a job here. It's harder to get a job here than it is to get into Harvard. But boy, now that you're in, that's just the first step. Now you have to cut it, and most of you aren't going to make it because this place is only the best and the brightest. And you start learning the language. You start learning all the various kind of language shifts that they use in a way that's very much like what cults do. Cults sort of change. They invent their own way of describing things. If you look at Scientology, it's weird that I was reading Lawrence Wright's book, Going Clear, when I was working here, and it was scary to me to see some of the parallels. And I don't think it's necessarily somebody sits down and plans it out, like, let's do what the Scientologists do. But I think they use some of the same techniques. Like, this company isn't just about selling software. This is about changing people's lives. This is about making people better and achieving your goals and conquering fear and personal empowerment and just being the best you can be. So there's a lot of talk about that, sort of the rhetoric about personal growth and how amazing it is. But to get there, you have to buy in and you have to stay on the ladder and keep going up. And so that gets baked in very quickly, right, in training. We're the best, and you just buy in. And if you do that, things go really, really well for you.
And that works for a lot of people. I mean, that's a good thing for a lot of people, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And there are even people who are kind of aware of the cultiness of it, but they still like it. I had a friend there whose sister, I got to know her pretty well, and then I got to know her sister. And her sister was a little bit cynical and would always refer to it as the cult. And so would my friend. She'd be like, yeah, I got to go into the cult tomorrow. But she was self-aware enough to know what it was like, but she also knew that she liked it and she fit in and she had friends there and she enjoyed it. So, yeah, it works for a lot of people.
So one of the things on HBO's comedy series, the Silicon Valley, which is set at a startup, it's about startups and it's about startups seeking venture capital and going for their IPO. One of the things that's satirized on that series, which you've written for two seasons, is that how this collision of the utopian idealism that everybody preaches in the startups and the cutthroat competition that's actually happening between them, the kind of ruthless competition behind the scenes. And I'm wondering if you've observed that both as a reporter and as somebody who worked in the tech industry.
Oh, absolutely. And the funny thing to me is that I think when I first started covering technology, I was covering places like Intel and Microsoft, the personal computer guys. They never really talked about having this big mission to change the world or make the world a better place or describing themselves like, you know, Mother Teresa or Nelson Mandela. They didn't see themselves that way. They were pretty much, you know, the Microsoft guys especially were just, we're going to build a company. We're going to sell a lot of stuff. We're going to make a lot of money. But ironically, they actually did make things that kind of did change the world. I mean, the microprocessor that Intel invented, that whole family of microprocessors really did change the world. But I don't think Andy Grove ever talked in that kind of sappy, syrupy way about how he wanted to change the world. Andy Grove wanted to make chips and make money. The new guys, ironically, have much less interesting companies in a lot of ways and much less meaningful companies and are making much easier things that aren't really even technically challenging. But they talk a lot about changing the world and being on a mission. And it's almost like there should be a meter. And the more someone or a company talks about changing the world and being on a mission, the probably less important their stuff really is. I think they're disproportionately related to each other. So that's what I saw happening in from the 90s onward. As the companies became sillier, the rhetoric became more grandiose.
So let me just ask you this point blank. You say you wrote the memoir to entertain. But since some people at your company probably are wondering about this, did you also want to get even with some of the people who you feel treated you unfairly or didn't understand you?
I think I felt pretty hurt when I left, when I first left there. By the time I was writing and rewriting the book, I think I actually had less of that feeling. I kind of feel that people do the best they can do in whatever circumstance. So, for example, I had a boss who was my friend, or I thought we were friends. We were very close for a while, who then I think it was basically given to him as a mission to get rid of me by making me unhappy. And I, at the time, thought, boy, that was a crummy thing to do. Looking back now, I think, in a way, he was maybe caught in a bad spot, too. The other thing that happened is when I first sold the book and started to write it, it was meant to be sort of a modern-day Office Space, which is the other famous Mike Judge project other than Silicon Valley and Beavis and Butthead. But I wanted to write just a funny story about being in a kooky company. It was just a comedy. And then as I started writing and rewriting, I started doing the thing where you ask yourself, why is it like this? Why are there these kooky cultures and these frat houses and these sort of culty aspects? And that led me to a much bigger story, I think. And that became much more interesting to me and remains much more interesting to me than whatever kind of things happened at my particular job.
So having covered the tech industry and then worked in it, do you think that age bias is a serious issue? And outside of your own personal experiences, what are some of the things that you think older people are up against, either in getting hired or in keeping a job?
Well, I think the tech industry is open about it. There's not even a secret. With racial bias and gender bias, they at least sort of pay lip service to saying, well, we're going to do better and we're going to start this initiative and we've put some money over here to create this and that. But with older workers, they just say, no, we don't really want the older workers. It's fine. And they don't bother to even kind of lie. I think those forms of discrimination all go hand in hand.
Do you think that culture is changing a little bit in the sense that some of the tech founders have aged? Some of the venture capitalists have probably aged because the tech industry isn't as new now as it was, say, in the 90s.
Yes. And I think, so Mark Zuckerberg once famously said when he was like 20 or 22, young people are just smarter. That was the famous quote, right? And I wonder as Mark Zuckerberg gets to be, I think he's 30 now, but when he gets to be 40 or 50, will he feel differently about that? You know, the Google guys are now probably well into their 40s. So yeah, I think as some of these people, the young Turks become the old guard, maybe they start to realize, we could have a greater diversity of workers around here.
Do you think that some of the emphasis on being young, too, is kind of drawing the line between people who are digital natives and people who aren't? You know, like people who grew up with computers, and so a lot of things are just second nature to them in a way that older people had to learn from scratch because it was introduced to them. It wasn't something they grew up with.
I think there's validity to that. But there's also this, the way it's described is almost like everybody born after 1980 has a gene that the rest of us don't have, that they were born with this thing that somehow they can understand this. Now, I do know my kids are very good at picking up new things and they're learning how to code in Python. And I'm not a coder at all, but I'm pretty sure I could learn to write code in Python pretty quickly if I had to. And I think it's not just that. It's people who have been working as coders, as programmers, as engineers, who get kicked out when they turn 40 or 45. They have tech skills. They have degrees in computer science. It's not believable to me that they couldn't learn whatever the new programming language is. Also, they've put in those 10,000 hours that Malcolm Gladwell talks about that to gain expertise and a skill. Why would you not want them? They've learned their skills on someone else's dime, and now you can hire them and get the benefit of all that experience. So, yeah, there's a trade-off in that younger workers maybe are digital natives, and they probably have more energy, and they don't have spouses and kids, so they're less distracted. But I think there's a real value to the experience and the wisdom and the knowledge that older workers have. And I just don't think we're genetically different species. I don't think we're a different being than people who were born in 1980 or 1990.
Dan Lyons, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dan Lyons' new memoir is called Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Kevin Griffin. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Schalliner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.